Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
My name is Jim.
Doug.
Justin.
George.
Will.
Michael.
Kay.
Lee.
Cliff.
Bud.
Steve.
Kevin.
Jack.
Peter.
Patrick.
David.
Peter.
Julian.
Paul.
I'm also Paul.
This is Joe.
It's Tony.
Tony, I'm sorry. anyone here for the first time? Welcome.
Thank you.
Today we're lucky to have the speaker, Paul Ryder, who is a scholar of important issues like physics and psychology and religion and mythology.
I'm glad to be here. The thing I wanted to talk about today, for the next little bit, is the topic of evil. Is that exciting? It's going to be fun. And in particular about two images of evil. And I'll talk about those two specific images in a little bit. But the first thing is to think about a few preliminaries about evil. One, why we don't really talk about it very much. And certainly in Buddhist circles, you know, I would venture to say I'm one of the few that speakers in here that be very committed want to talk about evil. And I think part of that has to do with the ultimate image in the Buddhist tradition of enlightenment really doesn't contain a whole lot of evil because you've moved into the space of the one, and the opposites disappear. You know, self and other, spirit and matter, good and bad, all those things sort of dissolve into the one, and so evil, along with it, disappears. So why would you talk about it? I think the other reason we don't talk about it very much is that in a sort of democratic world where every opinion gets a vote, it's a very slippery topic to say one thing is evil and one thing is not. And so I won't be offering you a definition of evil today that you can take out and, you know, put on a fortune cookie and say, well, there it is. Glad we tidied that up. What's culturally okay for one person may not be culturally okay for another person. So to say one thing is evil and one thing is not is a difficult distinction to make. What might seem evil on its surface, say a president who invades another country, can become ambiguous if you think about it in terms of self-defense. So we even see this sort of slipperiness of what is evil happening in our culture. Part of the challenges here is that but at the same time, we want evil to be evil. We want to sort of isolate it, vilify it, cut it off, repress it, and push it away. And if we could find it, we'd be better off without it. We're certain of that. Finally, I think we don't talk about evil because in a way we're attached to it in a reverse way. That this pushing away is, in a Buddhist sense, an attachment as much as it is us wanting to draw things that are desirable to us. We typically talk about attachment with things that are what we would want to be bringing toward us. You know, I want my car, my house, my peace of mind, whatever it is that we feel like we're attached to, that we should be shedding these attachments. At the same time, the things we don't want, we're equally attached to keeping them out. So in that sense, we also don't really think about evil a whole lot. So two pieces of background that might be useful before I get into these specific images of evil. One is how I got involved in this topic and also how I got to be here. Justin read a paper of mine, and I'm a student in mythology. And the paper was about sort of comparing and contrasting a couple of different images of evil. So the proximate cause for me being here today is that Justin read a paper called Clint. And Clint invited me to come and speak, and I said, sure, I'll come and speak. The original paper was actually written for a course on folklore and fairy tales. So it wasn't necessarily coming out of a Buddhist tradition at that point. And I began to think about, well, you know, how is this topic related to Buddhism? And I am a study, the folklore mythology class is part of a PhD program in mythology. So that, you know, all those biases are in there too, that I view the world from viewing most religious traditions as mythological systems. For my own background, I'm both a meditator and I do a lot of yoga, like probably a lot of you guys do, and a lot of San Francisco residents do. Part of the way of approaching evil is looking at imagery of evil, and that's a different approach than, you know, trying to define it or quantify it or wrap a logical word-based framework around it, but instead sort of put aside that definitive, nominalistic approach to saying, how do we name it, how do we find it, how do we put it in a box and clarify it? And instead look at images that we've seen, cultural images of evil. And I'd like to talk a little bit about images in particular, and to talk about the image that I referred to before, the image of enlightenment. To give you an idea of how images work in our psyches. So if you close your eyes for a second, and let me just follow with a couple of questions. Ask yourself the question, what exactly would enlightenment be like if I were enlightened? How would I feel? How would I live? What would be the first thing I did when I woke up in the morning? As an enlightened person, what specifically would I do or say when a homeless person asked me for money? Think of a minor dispute or disagreement you've had with someone, something where the outcome didn't really matter. You know, with a meter maid, with a waiter, with a neighbor. How would you approach that dispute as an enlightened being? Be specific in your image, because it's not fair saying I would approach the person with compassion. Too abstract. What does compassion look like in this context? Okay, with that, open your eyes. And what came to mind? Looking for answers. What came to mind as you were thinking about that?
Well, the first thing I thought I would do when I wake up is meditate.
Okay.
That was one of your specific questions.
Right.
The fact that what came to mind was there's no way I could answer that question because I'm not enlightened, so I don't know what it would be like to talk to Peter Bates as an enlightened
person. Okay. Right?
Although I suspect that if you, you know, were a meter maid did something you didn't like as an enlightened person, you would not get angry and would understand that it really didn't matter that much and would try to understand the situation from the meter maid's perspective. I mean, that's what I would think.
Okay.
Person would do.
I know a meter maid that would not be possible.
The meter maid really stuck in people's minds. Go ahead.
For me, I think the hardest image to come up with, or the hardest dilemma to deal with, was the homeless person. And no one's spoken about that. I'm really up in the air about that. And that was a really hard thing for me. Because I found that lately I've been trying to be grateful for what I have and sharing what I have in a monetary way with people who aren't as fortunate as I am. So that one is really difficult for me. Because I find there's a lot of fear in there for me, continuing with that person, fear that this won't be used as what I would think is a positive false service and judging there, but it might go to something like trouble or something awful. So that was a really tough one for me. Thank you for asking us to envision that.
Okay.
Well, I usually feel irritation when I see homeless people.
Okay.
I was struck by how individualistic and personalist the question is. To me, enlightenment, the whole world's enlightened or nobody is. Really, because homelessness is not, it's not all about me. It's really not all about me. The person is homeless because of a lot of different social things, and it's a matter of what we do to change the culture.
Okay.
But really, it struck me that I don't think the way you were asking the question. My goal is not to be enlightened. My goal is to help change society.
Okay. Let me back up, and that's a good spot to kind of keep going with this, because one way I want to tie together what I hear people saying is that I'm trying to find an image or a way in my head of dealing with these things. So the image may not be a visual image, but there's some sort of, you know, I would feel gratitude, I would feel compassion. I'm trying to access this thing inside of me. Or this image of, you know, what would the Buddha do in this case? Instead of what would Jesus do, we can get new bumper stickers. So what would Buddha do? That we're looking for an image or some way of guiding us in an ambiguous situation. And that was the sort of the intent of the exercise, to have us do the process saying, how do I decide? How do I, you know, sort of move myself in an ambiguous or fearful or confusing situation, like facing the homeless or facing a meter maid and going, I don't know what to do here. I have an image in my head that says, the thing I really want to do right here is not the thing that's most appropriate or that's not most Buddhist. And so you feel inside there's this competition between an image of what an enlightened being would do and this image of what I really feel like doing right now. And it was the exercise was to give us an opportunity to feel that the two images that may be, you know, pushing us, or three or four or five images that may be pushing us at any given time, especially in situations where we're doing something new or creative or that isn't habitual. And so with that as a background on imagery and how images guide our understanding in ambiguous situations, I want to talk a little bit about two images of evil that are in the popular culture. And one is the image from Lord of the Rings, and the other one is the image from Star Wars. So just as a hand check, how many people have seen Lord of the Rings? We'll do Lord of the Rings first. Seen Lord of the Rings. So I want to make sure that I'm not, or read the books. So maybe 2/3. And how many folks have seen Star Wars? Well, Lucas is doing better. And you don't have to have an in-depth knowledge of the works to follow the logic of the talk I'm going to give. They both actually, among other things, wrestle with a common theme, and that's the nature of evil. They provide us with sort of a complete image of evil in the sense that where it came from, how it got there, where it's going, what's the characters, how the characters in the stories recognize good, evil, and truth. But as I began to think about the images of evil, they're actually very, very different. And probably their biggest difference is that let me back up a second. The thrust of the difference and why I think it's relevant to Buddhism is I think that there's, in Tolkien's view, it's a more traditional Christian and Western view. And in Lucas's view, and I think this is intentional, it's an Eastern and could be considered a Buddhist or Hindu view. For those who haven't seen the movies, I'll give a quick background. And we'll talk about first the Tolkien's view and how that image of evil pervades our culture and certainly the rhetoric of politics. If you remember, in Tolkien's view, that evil is monotheistic. It's detached. It has its own location. You know, the Dark Lord Sauron governs a particular region of Middle-earth. He's independent of the rest of Middle-earth. The place in which he lives is inhabited by the corrupt. You know, they're irredeemable. They're not headed anywhere. And they're one-dimensional for the most part. All the different characters, the orcs and the Nazgul and all the creations that he's created are all these sort of one-dimensional bad guys. If they were in a Western, they'd all be wearing black hats. And there isn't really any ambiguity as to whether these are good guys or bad guys. They're all the bad guys. The other thing that is characteristic of this image is that it's independent of the good. That this image of evil is amassing an army, getting ready to attack Middle Earth, and its movement and its decision making is in no way related to the good side of things. And the people the free people, the white hat people of Middle Earth, are all getting ready to defend from this coming attack. In Lucas's view, which would be, I think, much more in keeping with an Eastern tradition, you don't see this bifurcation of the image. You see only that the force is one. And that the characters, you know, Luke Skywalker is always sort of playing on this edge of, well, would that be evil? Well, no, it's not evil. Well, is that evil? Well, no, it's not evil. Is that good? Well, no. You know, the force doesn't have, you can't say it's good and you can't say it's bad. The Christian image separates evil into two, you know, so there's God and there's Satan. And they're pretty much independent actors, whereas the force is this united thing where actions happen and reactions happen, but there isn't this bifurcation. The ways in which the characters, and the reason these two images are important, is the ways in which the characters interact with this form of evil tells you a lot about what happens when you carry one, when we prefer one image over the other. If you see everything as united and whole, then you have a certain relationship to that. Whereas if you see evil as bifurcated from good and split, then you have a different relationship to it. In the characteristic action of someone who sees the world as bifurcated into good and evil, is that it's one-dimensional. You have to pick good or bad, and then you relate to good or bad in that sense. You don't really have an alternative. You only have a one-dimensional relationship because you've split good and evil into two parts. Whereas on the other side, when you have this monistic one, you actually have a much more complex relationship with it. So instead of saying, well, that's bad, that's evil, that's wrong, watching it, looking at it, saying, this is all coming from the one. It's all coming from the force in Lucas's way of thinking. Then you can form some sort of relationship to it. And you can form some sort of interaction with it. Let me stop there actually and ask one, if the distinction I'm making between these two images makes sense, and for especially for those who haven't seen the movies, I didn't realize so many people hadn't necessarily seen them or read the books. So does the bifurcation or the distinction between the two and the way in which we carry our own image or our own feeling of what is evil, does that make any sense?
I'm thinking about recent rhetoric in the culture of if you're not with us, you're against us,
mm-hmm.
and who, you know, that there are evildoers, and the lack of an ability to see gray. And I hate bringing politics into it, but I can't help but thinking that our president identifies himself as a fundamentalist Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think part of what happens is that he has an inability to handle psychological or moral complexity.
Right.
And it seems to me that and what got me excited about your paper originally was this idea that Lucas, and I think Buddhism, comes from an idea that moral judgments are more complex and ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a way, it's not comforting. It's a little uncomfortable to think, well, I can't see the world in black and white and be all in the white.
Right.
But I think that discomfort is a necessary part of growth. So I found the concept very helpful.
It's in particular, if you look at the way that the decisions leading up to the Iraq War, in terms of you see this image of Powell, you know, in the paper, constantly in dialogue, constantly talking. You see him sort of yucking it up with the Iraqi information minister, who turned out to be the Iraqi entertainment minister. Because of the sort of goofy things he was saying later in the war. But he's still in dialogue and having this conversation with these people that are ostensibly evil. And at the same time, you don't see Bush having any of those conversations. Bush is on his ranch, isolated from the world, saying, they're all bad out there.
Evil is defined by certain people. Just, you said that evil is one. Clarify that you're... That's defined by certain people.
Well, defined by Bush.
Thank you. I just want to make sure
you're... Okay, right. That he's sitting isolated in his ranch, one, also believing that he is good, and therefore, this bifurcation of I am good, they are evil. Whereas you have the... And I'm just giving you a characteristic. If you carry one image, which is that good and evil can be separated, and that there is a moral absolute and that there is black and white, you end up sitting on your ranch in Crawford talking about war, which is not unlike what we see in Tolkien's work, which is pretty much the whole book is about a coming war. There's no ambiguity, there's no change, there's no suspense in the sense of I wonder if Gandalf's going to become a bad guy. One of the good guys is going to switch or one of the bad guys is going to switch. You don't really ever see that ambiguity when you carry that particular good guys, bad guys, moral absolute image. If you look at this sort of in the Buddhist tradition, which I think you'd also would see the political image of what Powell is doing. He's always in conversation with the dark side.
As defined by Bush.
Right.
Right. I just want to make sure that you're using these labels as somebody defines them versus this is what's really true. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right, I do. And
so it means like when Powell's talking to these evil people or when we're dealing with the dark side, I just want to clarify that these are terms that are... Are these terms you're using that this is what really the case or this is like as seen through the eyes of a certain person?
I would would say seen by the eyes of a certain person, and I think I would challenge the idea that there is any absolute at all. So it's, you know, Bush's image, which is an image that you know, a lot of us grow up with in terms of Satan and the devil and the bad guys and the movies and, you know, all of that, is an image that we all carry inside of us of what is good and what is bad. The approach that you see in Lucas, and also the approach that you would see in any diplomatic kind of conversation, is that you're still always exploring, you're still always looking for alternatives, you're still always in dialogue with something that may make you feel really uncomfortable. And you always run the risk of finding out that you, from their point of view, are the evil one. Whereas Bush never runs that risk, you know, and the Tolkien books never run that risk. That's another image that we have that I think is a more complex image of when we're thinking about things that are undesirable, that we don't want, that we go, I'm not sure if I would invite that into my life if I could avoid it. In an Eastern sense and in a Buddhist sense, that pushing those things away and saying that's wrong is an image that, you know, is an image that we have of that we've grown up with of you know, evil's bad, we should push it away. And then there's this other image that we have an opportunity to use that says, well, what's in there? How would I explore that? What's in the dark, not dark bad, but dark unknown? The constant conversation that you see in diplomacy is an effort to bring what is hidden to the surface so that we can look at it, to bring it from the unconscious to consciousness, to become aware of, you know, well, what's really going on here before we decide that it's all bad and we should just send some jets over and wipe it out. Does that...
Let's continue.
We're
going to
have questions that
they will have. Well, okay. That's, well, I just want to make sure that we're... Go ahead.
Well, it seems to me the connection between this and Buddhism and other religions, for that matter, is the relative and absolute levels. So that on the relative level, there's suffering and there's good and evil, but underneath that lies the absolute level. On the relative level, lions eat rabbits and people eat beef and cows, and that's bad. On the absolute level, this is a part of all that exists, and it's not bad. I had the chance to hear Pema Chodron, who was here on Wednesday night, and she just briefly, she talked about the issue of anger. And contended that behind anger always lies fear. And behind fear, if you can get behind it, lies what she calls the soft spot. Which we could also call compassion. And behind that lies the deep blue sky. And if you look at the other religious traditions, including Christianity, there is still the inclination towards salvation, of saving those who are evil. If you look at Jesus Christ or Buddha, taking the people who are, you know, considered evil, and they become saved and compassionate. Or if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, in the end, Brahm, the force of good, vanquishes Ravina, the source of evil. And then in the letter that comes afterwards from Ravina, the source of evil, the devil, if you like, says, you know, I've just been waiting for you to finally vanquish me, because this is, I see my path as unsatisfying, and I was waiting for this to happen.
Right.
So it seems to me that that's the reconciliation, and it also strikes me that when we make those divisions, we perpetuate. So, you know, we could take a boat.
Thank you. So we talked about, you know, both about political images, and we talked about religious images, and we talked about literary images. And I want to talk a little bit about how those those images govern, like I asked you at the beginning about your image of enlightenment. You know, when you're confronted with X, you know, where do you go? What happens in here that says, I'm trying to figure out what to do here. I feel like I would want to do this because I'm a practicing, you know, I'm a practicing Buddhist, so I would, this is the thing I want to do, and the image that I have in my head of what a Buddhist would do here is X. That process is a very normal psychological process whenever you're faced with something that you don't understand or that you haven't seen before. In the psychological arena, how we conceive of evil is one of the most important things I think that we face. We try to follow the Eightfold Path. And there's a lot of rights in the Eightfold Path. You know, the right action, right livelihood. What does that look like specifically? That same, you still have that same problem of, well, what does right livelihood look like for me? And then the attendant, what does wrong livelihood look like for me? We often speak of our minds as something that is a distraction. But every once in a while, the mind brings us a gift of understanding. So how do you know when the mind is bringing you something that is a gift versus when the mind is bringing you something that's a distraction? We often try to transcend the ego, is one of the sort of statements that you hear in the Buddhist tradition, but at the same time, we need the ego to function in the world. That having that conversation with the meter maid requires both this sort of unconscious orientation, but it requires an ego, otherwise you don't do anything. You can't just stand there and be compassionate. Perhaps with a meter maid you could. But if there was something life-threatening or something where you really had to resolve an issue, say, you know, with your landlord, otherwise you're going to be thrown out, you can't not do anything just standing there being compassionate. You know, you're required, your ego is required to get involved just to make a conversation with the person and engage them. But yet in that, there's as soon as that happens, then you're running on these images. You know, which image am I going to look at? As much as we'd like to transcend it all and make it go away, the nature of being incarnated is that we're constantly challenged to answer basic riddles about life. I think if we choose Tolkien's image, we have no alternative but to label some of our internal feelings as evil, and to push them away. And certainly, you know, parts, when if you're trying to follow the Eightfold Path, there are things along the Eightfold Path which you have to sort of say, well, I'm not going to do that. So we can't escape this image. You can't say, well, you know, we're just going to go over to Lucas's image where everything's united in one. We will live with this problem of saying, that's wrong, I'm not going to do that, psychologically. And actually, I think that's important. You know, we sort of, you know, have this preference, I think, for wanting to believe that Tolkien, or that the Lucas version of the one unified force is, you know, it's all relative. Underneath it all, it's all good. But yet, we still are faced with homeless people, and we still have to decide what to do about them. So we can't just sort of retreat to the absolute level where everything is one when we're confronted with suffering. So we still have to entertain both of these images at the same time. And there are times to say that that is inappropriate or wrong, and it's best to shut it down. And so I guess the point I'm trying to get at is that you've got these two images or these two alternatives to say, well, it's all relative, it's part of the unfolding, it's part of the grandeur, it's part of the blue sky that, that all exists behind in the formless void from which it all emerges.
Thought
my time was up.
No.
The formless void from which it, you know, it all emerges, and it's easy for us, I think, in some ways, to want to retreat to that place, the place that we perceive to be the absolute image or the absolute good. But yet we're confronted with this other world in which we do have to say, you know what, I'm going to have to decide, you know, this or this, and this is less desirable than that. And that's the beginning. That split is the beginning of something that would be, you know, much bigger than that, that if you took it to its extreme, you'd say, well, you know, making that distinction between the two, all of a sudden, well, now I can see where if you take it way out there, you end up in Bush's position. Or, you know, well, that's totally unacceptable, and we're cutting it off, and we're going to bomb it until it's gone. So, maybe I want to leave it there for a few minutes and open it up for a couple more questions. Because my attempt is just to sort of stimulate some thinking and see what your experience with these two images and how we work with them. Mike?
I really think that the Buddha Dharma doesn't really, it sort of engages this conversation beginning at a different level, at a level higher than the quandary of good and evil. I mean, the Buddha came in to talk with people, and his middle way was not between good and evil at all. It was about techniques, programs of enlightenment. One was recognizing dukkha as permeating the world. You know, everything is kind of meshed up here, and so that was the view of, you know, self-mortification and getting out of the world, that the world was a source of pain and suffering. But, and then the other was, you know, a desire to get the good things in life and an attempt to just make yourself happy, the common way, if you could call that, you know, the way of common people. And so he's wrestling with what is most effective to bring about happiness in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, you know, I think he's in the middle of a transformation of energy. And it's kind of like you're talking about Jesus teaching too, you know, trying to save his energy and get them all happy up to heaven or whatever he's about.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha was taking all those tendencies that make you unhappy, trying to get little happinesses here and there, and transforming that energy. Anyway, I don't see it as addressing good and evil, but addressing skillful means of. I see when you talk about the force being the energy, but it's transformational energy. It's in movement.
Right.
Whereas the good and evil, maybe Christianity or fundamentalism, is a static state of the universe, which you just have to get on the right side of.
Right.
This is movement of energy, movement of beings out of suffering and into happiness.
And it's that movement that makes it challenging to our minds that want things to be static. We want things to stay the same. And it's that movement that when it comes time for the Dalai Lama to fire his secretary because she's incompetent, how do you do that? You know, how does the Dalai Lama say, you know what? I know I'm a practicing Buddhist, but you know, you're not doing what we need. I keep missing my flights. You know. You know. You know. And so, at what point? You know, when you're in this sort of ambiguous rhythm of change, where you don't necessarily get to say, well, that's evil, just cut it off and throw it away. How do you confront with that image of what's undesirable, like a secretary who's not doing her job, when when you've got this tradition behind you and this feeling inside of you and this image of what would be compassionate here?
I think that's why the skillful means are numberless. Basically, you know? I mean, how does it? Watch him and see what he does with the secretary. And then you'll right. know what the skillful is, because I think he's pretty skillful.
Yeah. I'm still a little confused about the focus of the paper that you wrote.
Yeah.
Maybe I just haven't listened clearly enough. But I'm not sure about the connection between mythology and the mythological perspective and the nature of Buddhism. I mean, Tolkien is himself merely an exemplar of a tendency, of a viewpoint that exists in the culture. And Lucas also, what he did in Star Wars. I mean, they're both extremely derivative from that point of view. So are you talking about this in a rhetorical sense, in the way that our images or the words that we choose to represent things control our thoughts? Or are you talking more specifically about people being influenced by the Tolkien movie and the Tolkien vision and the Star Wars vision as they're disseminated in the culture? I'm not really clear what you're...
Yeah, well, both. They are both derivative and reflective of what's in the culture, but by giving it form, they also become ways in which those images are perpetuated. Because, you know, they're crystallizing the Tolkien in particular is crystallizing the Christian myth in a particular context. Lucas is crystallizing the Eastern myth in a particular context, and myth being not what's false, but just general way of viewing culturally the way things are. And then through that crystallization also informing the culture back, because now it's clearer than it may have been had they not done the works that they produced. Does that answer your question?
Well, I'm not... I guess I'm just not clear where the weight of your argument is. I mean, is it about how we could deal with Tolkien and Lucas to help people better achieve enlightenment or better deal with the problem of evil? Or is it the idea that evil is beyond Tolkien and Lucas both, and that we don't... In other words, do you think mythology itself has a way of dealing with evil and they just happen to be poor exemplars? Or do you think that mythology doesn't deal with evil very well, and that's what they're showing us?
I think that the weight of the argument is around how we carry these images inside of us, and I'm using Lucas and Tolkien as two exemplars because I thought they would be things that a majority of people would understand. We also used Bush and Powell in the same way, that they are exemplars of what happens when you view the world a certain way. I'm not sure that there's a preference for either one, and that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that there are times when it's appropriate to say that's wrong and cut it off and shut it down for us psychologically to approach the world that way. And certainly a lot of the traditions and techniques are about do this and not these things. There is another point, which we were talking about over here, that in that absolute sense, that it does all emanate from the one. And it can be relativized. And, you know, ultimately, whether the Dalai Lama fires his secretary or not does not affect the outcome of the universe. But at the same time, he still has to do it. You know, we still have to live in this culture. And so these images are somewhere, whether it's Tolkien and Lucas or Bush and Powell or, you know, the Buddha and the Christian tradition, I'm not sure Christ would be, you know, on the side of good and evil. Or the more fundamentalist view. But we all have these images inside of us and we all carry them. And we all have to weigh when we're confronted with something that's challenging, difficult, or creative that we haven't done before. How are we going to move in one direction or the other.
Listening to you today, I've been thinking, and I hesitate to speak because I haven't thought this out. It may not be coherent, but ideas...
That doesn't stop me.
Go for it.
But, right at the beginning, you talked about evil, and I thought, well, who else have I read about evil? Because it's an intriguing topic, and Scott Peck has an interesting book, People of the Lie. So I'm kind of thinking of that, and then this black and white thinking. Well, he talks about stages of spiritual development, and black and white thinking is kind of an earlier stage, and then people move beyond that. And another idea was, I work with drug addicts, and in very early recovery, black and white thinking is very important for them to get through this to later stage of development. Now, I can have somebody in my office and be talking to them, a cocaine addict or something, and they're very engaging individuals and tell wonderful stories. But this guy, you know, assaulted his girlfriend 2 days ago and, or, you know, raped his daughter. It's a fascinating topic. And, you know, where is the locus of evil?
I think in the one of the points you're making is an important one, is that at certain stages of development or in certain situations for us, that black and white thinking is perfectly appropriate and perfectly acceptable. And that there's a point at which, as we're developing, that we can take a more relativistic approach and say, well, you know, what is this riddle that I'm being faced with, and which side of it's really the good side, and which side of it's really the evil side, and I'm not really sure. And that as the riddles of life get more complicated, partly because we've answered the earlier ones with our black and white thinking, that exploration and the transition in of your image of evil from just good versus evil to something that's more a dialogue with what's in the dark, is perfectly appropriate too. And that knowing the difference and knowing when you're shifting from one to another is an important psychological skill, and an important skill in terms of being aware of, as we raise our awareness, what kind of engagement are we making now and how are we doing it. But I agree with you that in earlier stages, and you know, certainly you don't, you know, you do it with children. This is, you know, you're allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. When I said be home at 10:30, I meant 10:30. And the kids that don't get that structure actually end up with bigger problems.
It's new. Yeah, it's been great. Thank you very much. I'd love to hear more on this topic.
Announcements. It's a big topic.
It's a big topic. Yeah.
Stirs up.
Thanks, Paul. Come back.
Thank you.
Announcements. Our host is setting up.
Paul. Your host is what?
He's setting up in the other room.
Oh, sorry. Next week we're going to discuss the possibility of opening up the Gay Women's Fellowship for Women. So it's a discussion, not a debate, but it's a
friendly discussion.
It's a friendly discussion, not a friendly debate. And so please come. Eventually we'll consider it at the steering committee meeting. The next one would be in actually November. But we're going to begin discussing. So if you haven't already, Clint has an argument for it in the latest newsletter. So that might be a good springboard for people to consider what they might want to bring to a discussion.
Well, and considering that discussion, is it the whole Chiplet community? Okay, it has been transsexual.
Well, we had the discussion. It was basically the main thing I was hoping up to women. But yeah, hoping up to transgender minority, but particularly women.
Just one other thing, we do have a gay Buddhist group in the Yahoo And I actually think that would be a useful forum to discuss this too, because we're only going to be meeting for an hour, and I don't think anybody would be able to express their views in that time. And it is kind of, it is a weighted topic apparently for some people. So if you are interested in this discussion, I suggest you use the Yahoo group to start voicing the pros and cons, because you know, that way you can be able to start looking at how people feel. Well, unrelated points. The newsletter says Jim Wolf is going to speak the first Sunday of next month. That's when we're having a retreat, so that was a mistake on my part. So that will be an open discussion with Jim Wolf speak. Third, finally, I had a program with GDF, the Hamilton Family Center group. The issue of homelessness came up today. We do provide a meal once a month, second Saturday every month. It's a very rewarding experience. And if you feel like something that you'd like to volunteer for as far as helping prepare the meal, serve it, contact me during the break.
The GBF is having fall retreat. Retreat will start in afternoon or early evening of Friday, September 5th, and will end after lunch on Sunday, September 7th. Registration is still accepted, and the registration forms are in the other room. So if you ever fantasize about sleeping with a bunch of other gay men among the redwoods, that gives you opportunity. Actually, more accurately, it will be awakening with other gay men.
We've got tea and some refreshments. Please clean up your cups. Peter,
you have one? Yeah, I'm the host coordinator, and Harv, who's host today, I think, volunteered to fill in today. We've had a resignation, so we need someone. Harv isn't here all year round. We need a volunteer for someone to be a host. It's a task that occurs once every 2 months, so it's not onerous. If you think you'd be willing to do that, check with me afterwards.
David?
Just briefly, if anyone would like to help design and organize the refuge ceremony in September, please talk to me.
Okay, and we also have a donut bowl outside. We request $5 if that's doable or more. Less, whatever's appropriate. There's a sign up sheet for anyone here for the first time if you'd like to get on the email list with it, get some newsletter. I think that's it. We can all help put this stuff away. Anybody else? Okay, let's stand and plug in. Well, let's return to that moment, that fresh moment, waking in the morning. We're all Buddhists, and we remember that we're Buddhists. What do we do?
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.